Hi, everybody. Welcome to True Stories of Tinseltown. And hey, everybody who's just listening to me on Racketeer Radio. And I'm really happy to be here. I have been doing podcasts for a long time. And today I have a very special guest. He loves racketeers. He might have been one in his early life. When he was six, he was ready to rob a bank. And he's written a book about George Raft that's fabulous. And he knows everything about gangsters that you're afraid to ask. He knows it all. And I'm here with my friend Stone Walls. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much, Grace, for that great introduction. And what a pleasure and what a appropriate situation to be in with Racketeer Radio.
I know. Well, thanks, Ace, for putting me here. I think he did a great job with programming, and he's got some really good shows. So check it out, and I hope you guys like this show, and you will love my friend Storm. So don't you love that name, you guys? Doesn't that sound like a racketeer? So tell us about your robbing a bank when you're six. I was only kidding. He didn't really. He wanted to, but he didn't.
Well, I wasn't caught. Let's put it that way.
My biggest hoist was when I was about six. And you know how they make mini criminals at grocery stores in the United States? I don't know if they do it in Canada, where you're from. But they put the candy and the gum low when you're checking out. So it's like kid level. And it's like, take me, take me. I mean, it's right there. It's like, become a crook. So I stole a juicy fruit, family-sized thing of gum. So when I got home, I did one of these stupid things, and it dropped it out of the car and said, look, somebody must have lost. Bad actress, 4 or 5. And my mother made me go by. She didn't believe my story, and I had to go back to the cashier and bring back my stolen goods. So I'm not a good heister.
Well, she prevented a Bonnie Parker, right?
She did. Thank you, mother.
A potential Bonnie Parker.
I could have been in the slammer right now, you know. I could have been I could be up the big house in the Hooskow. Okay.
In the Hooskow.
Yeah, so Stone and I are going to talk today about our 30s gangsters, and we're going to talk about the movies they did that got them started out. And so our first is, because I guess he was like the first big dude, is Edward G. Robinson in Little Caesar, I'm sorry.
Where he played Rico.
Yes, I'm Rico, yes.
Rico Bandello. Caesar on Rico Bandello. Hence the title Little Caesar, which is based on the novel by W.R. Burnett, who was a Chicago newsman who knew the gangster situation in Chicago during the 20s and wrote the novel Little Caesar, loosely based on the life of Al Capone. Warner Brothers bought the rights to the novel, and that was the first of the major gangster films, although, of course, there had been gangster films filmed previously, some starring the great Lon Chaney. Then there was also the movie with Alibi with Chester Morris, for which he received an Academy Award nomination.
Did he really?
Yes, the first actor playing a gangster ever to receive that nomination. The second one was James Cagney later on for Angels with Dirty Faces. Neither won the award, of course, but both were nominated.
Which was good in itself, because generally you don't like those kind of gangster things. You don't usually get nominated. But I think now you do. I think... But not in those days.
It's a different situation now. We'll talk about, when we get to talking about Cagney and Angels, we can talk about the story about the nomination and why he didn't win the Oscar, although he did receive the New York Critics Film Award for his portrayal of Rocky Sullivan. But we'll get to that in time as we start on the earlier films.
Right. So we are talking about Little Caesar, and Edward G. got the job.
Attended the Academy, American Academy of Dramatic Arts.
Like many.
Top-notch, mm-hmm. Yes, like many. Top-notch students. began working on the stage, and of course eventually made it to Broadway, where his big hit, of course, was playing, of course, a gangster in the story The Racket, where he played a gangster named Nick Scarcy, again loosely based on Al Capone. And that brought him, I think, to theatrical prominence, offered some movie contracts, and he did some early silent films and some sound films. And some of his early sound films prior to Little Caesar did see him cast as a gangster in films like Outside the Law, A Hole in the Wall, I believe, and The Widow from Chicago. So these are films in which he played hoodlum-type roles, and eventually led him to play Rico in Little Caesar.
Yeah, because he was certainly not your stereotypical new sign-up for any of these studios. He had very unique looks, and
yes.
he looked great as a gangster. And eventually he did so many wonderful parts, but I guess that's probably why they hired him, Mr. Gangster Dude.
Well, the thing about Edward G. Robinson is that he was completely opposite from the character he became associated with in crime films.
Mm-hmm.
He was an educated art enthusiast, a very cultured man, a man of fine tastes. And he, I think found himself surprised to realize he was being cast as a criminal in these early Hollywood films.
But he did a fabulous job in that. And to me, he was sort of like, it also starred Douglas Fairbanks Jr., and that was like his
right.
BFF. But it was also in Glenda Farrell, who was Mr. Fairbanks Jr.'s chick. He became a dancer with her. And little Rico didn't like that too much. Rico didn't like it because I think he had a mad, passionate feeling for him. So perhaps he was the first gangster that was gay, but it was not supposed to be obvious. But to me, it was in the movie.
It's interesting because if you read the novel by W.R. Burnett, there's no indication whatsoever that Rico might be swayed in that direction. In fact, he doesn't even like Joe Masseria, the character played by Douglas Fairbanks.
Mm-hmm.
So the scriptwriters of the movie obviously added that little interesting subplot to the story, which is quite subtle given the time, of course, even being a pre-code. But there is that telling line where Rico is about to shoot Joe and stops himself from doing it. And then he says to Otero, played by Georgie Stone, he says, well, that's what I get for liking a guy too much. And that's the one telling line in the movie where you kind of say there's a little bit more to that than just a male friendship.
Definitely. And he never, like most gangsters, they had a mall. He didn't have one. He had that guy. Was that the guy who's with him when he's standing in the mirror looking at himself all dressed up? And the guy's saying, hey, Bless, you look so good. You look so handsome. It really does something for you. And he's like, yeah, it does, doesn't it? But that to me.
Yeah, he's primping himself in front of the
mirror.
Right. First, he doesn't like himself in the tuxedo. He calls it a monkey suit. And then you see him, he's kind of looking and admiring himself. Because the one quality about Rico, and it's in the book as well, is that he's very vain. And that does come through in the characterization of Robinson like it does in the book.
But also, the guy is sitting and just like, kissing his toes, telling him how great he looks. And yeah, boss.
Well, that's the thing, because, that's Robinson's Rico has a thing for Joe, Douglas Fairbanks Jr., but Otero, George E. Stone, has a thing for Rico. And you can see that. That's actually even more... I think, open than the relationship between Joe and Rico.
Yes. But you can, I think Edward G. Robinson puts it across. And I know some people say, they're making that up. But it's not, it's nothing bad. This was his friend. His friend didn't want to be a hood anymore. And he becomes a dancer and leaves his BFF behind. And his BFF ain't liking that. So,
no.
I mean, you can see it any way you want, but I do see subtleties for that and for the other guy liking and loving Rico.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's true. I mean, when Otero is shot at the end and Rico's kind of cuddling him and Otero is saying, run, Rico, run. Like, in other words, protect yourself. Don't worry about me. I'm done for. And again, it's kind of like you can see a bit of an affection there.
Yes.
Between the two characters. And if you look at the way that Rico is holding him as he's dying, it's quite an affectionate move he has on on him at that point.
I have to check that out. I didn't notice that in the death scene. I will definitely have to check it out.
There's subtleties. Like you say, you can kind of interpret things however you want them. Yeah, you see things, you know, a certain way, and I kind of see it that way.
Yeah. And
another interesting point, just a quick to mention, though, is that the story that Edward G. Robinson gives is that when he was approached about appearing in Little Caesar, he was offered the Otero George E. Stone role, which I really think, and Robinson said, the only way I'll do this movie is if I play Rico, because if I play Otero, it's going to throw the whole picture off balance. And he's so right. Because
he was.
You can't see anybody else doing that part. Clark Gable, again, was another consideration, but not for Rico, but for the Douglas Fairbanks role.
Yeah, and Clark was just starting out anyway, so it wouldn't be like he was some, you know, yeah, big cheeseburger.
But don't forget, Clark Gable's early movies saw him a lot playing gangsters, too.
Yeah, The Secret Six?
Yep. Well, he was actually a newsman in that one, but he was a gangster in Dance, Fool's Dance, A Free Soul.
I love that with Norma Shearer. He was fab. You there?
Yes, I'm here. Yep. Mm-hmm.
That's all he said.
But he was very good in those films. I mean, he started off playing a hoodlum, a tough hoodlum, kind of along, you know, the lines of James Cagney, you know, not being too respectful of women. And when he finally did make his film, his last gangster film was the notorious Manhattan Melodrama. And after that, Gable kind of drifted away from playing those types of parts.
And became the leading man, the hunka-hunka burning love that he was supposed to be,
right.
A.K.A. almost, and almost the king,
exactly.
And did Love Stories. And I love the ones he did with Jean Harlow. I thought he did wonderful work. They were like a great team. But we digress a little bit, because we're going to get to the second really, really significant gangster flick in the 30s, which was The Public Enemy, with starring the incredible James Cagney. He was, what can I say about that film? It was just so great.
Well, that made him an instant star like Little Caesar did for Robinson. Those are really gangster movies, you know. They did a lot for these guys' careers. I mean, Cagney, you know, he signed with Warner Brothers, and, you know, he played a kind of a sniveling murderer in his first picture called Sinner's Holiday, which was based on the play Penny Arcade, which he and John Blondell did.
Yeah, they came over together,
Al Jolson bought the rights. But he had the stipulation that part of the deal was that Cagney and Blondell had to pay their stage roles. And so Cagney, you know, he was a secondary part. He pretty much took over that movie.
He really did. And that Ma, though, whoa, she was the wickedest Ma ever.
Lucille Laverne, yeah.
I love that name. And as an FYI, allegedly, she was the face of the evil witch in Snow White. They used her face in the cartoon to get the cartoon image. She was really, let's face it, she, you know, mirrors may have cracked in her presence a few times.
Yeah.
I feel mean saying it, but she was great. She was really great as that horrible Ma. Anyway, we're back to Public Enemy.
So that was, you know, James Cagney's film debut, and then he did a couple other pictures, small parts, like in The Millionaire with George Arliss and Other Man's Woman. And then he played his first gangster role, where he played Lou Ayres' right-hand man.
Who he trusted implicitly. And Lou was babyface Nelson. How old was Lou Ayres in that film?
How old was he?
Yeah, he must have been like 22 or 23 something.
He was younger than Cagney, definitely. Yeah, he would have been I would say that was 1930. That was 31, I think, or 30. So he would have been probably in his early 20s.
Yeah.
I believe, yeah. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's given orders to James Cagney, and you kind of watch that, and you kind of snicker, because you say, come on. You know, if ever role should have been reversed, like what happened with The Public Enemy, it's in that movie, because Cagney,
he steals the show. He steals the show, basically. Yes.
Well, but, you know, he did it from the beginning of his career, film career. I mean, he would just add these little things, little touches, like he said, stuff for the audience to take out of the theater with them. So he was so creative and so unique in his performances that he would do things that, you know, he was for a guy who never took an acting lesson in his life, he was just a born natural.
He really was. Why don't you tell everybody the story of how James got the part in Public Enemy?
Well, he was originally cast. Again, he wasn't, a big Hollywood name. He'd done a few films. But apparently Ed Wood, Eddie, what's his name? I can't think of Ed Wood, the director, but that was Eddie Woods, who was cast initially as Tom Powers because he was apparently engaged to Luella Parsons' daughter. So there was some kind of little nepotism thing happening there. And he was originally cast as Tom Powers, and Cagney was going to play the secondary role of Matt Doyle. Wellman shot a few days. I'd love to see that early footage. That would be interesting to watch them in
different
roles. Wouldn't that be great to see that?
Mm-hmm. Must have been horrific.
Wellman instantly said, oh, we got a big mistake here. You know, we got the wrong guys playing these mm-hmm. parts. So they switched roles, and Eddie Woods, he kind of went into a virtual obscurity after a while. I think he did a few other films.
He did, but he got little parts. Like he got
sort
of like elevator operators and things like that, which is unbelievable. But, you know, he just didn't have that oomph that Jimmy did. And, could you see him pushing that grapefruit into the lovely May Clark's face? I couldn't.
No. Or bossing Cagney around, like, you know, the way that Tom Powers pushes Matt around. I can't see, you know, Eddie Woods doing that to Jimmy Cagney. It just doesn't make any sense. I mean, it kind of worked in The Doorway to Hell. I kind of can buy that between him and Matt Lou Ayres. But no, and The Public Enemy just wouldn't have worked. It was totally the wrong roles. And it's a good thing that Wellman actually, you know, discovered that and made the switch. However, it would be interesting to find out, and I've never been able to discover what Eddie Woods, what his feelings were about losing that.
I can only imagine. And this part really made Cagney a star. This is what
would have made anybody a star. Yeah, but I mean, Cagney.
Well, if you were good enough, I don't think it would have made him a star, the kid who got, you know.
Maybe not a star, but he might have had a better career than he actually had. That's the point.
Yeah.
Because it was a colorful role. But I mean, only Cagney could do it.
Yeah, I mean, he had those face. You know, the facial tics, the arm movements of this, that. He was just fabs. Also, who was in that? There was Joan Blondell in that as well, but she did not play Jimmy's mall. She played the other guy who was supposed to be Jimmy's character.
She played Matt's wife.
Yes.
May Clark. May Clark was the girlfriend of Cagney.
But he dumped her pretty quick, yeah.
Yeah, he dumped May Clark for Jean Harlow.
Yes, she was a rich woman who liked excitement.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting because really when you watch the movie and that whole relationship between Cagney and Jean Harlow really doesn't go anywhere.
It doesn't. I mean, it's weird.
It is weird in a way because it doesn't really lead to anything. You know, when he finally walks out on her after learning that Nathan had been killed in a riding accident, she disappears. And that was actually based on a true story. That whole thing with the horse and buying the horse and shooting it.
Oh,
that actually happened. That was a part of Chicago underworld lore.
Yeah, that whole thing all about prohibition, and that's what all these mugs were doing. And so, he was wonderful in that film. You just can't take your eyes off of him, I think. Whenever he's in a film, you just can't take your eyes off for a minute. He's just so good. In the ending, could it be better? That was the best ending I think I've ever seen. And the creepiest, skeeved me. We're not going to say it just in case you haven't seen The Public Enemy, but if you have, you know what we're talking about. And
it's one of those movies, Grace, where you would wish you could go back in time and sit there with an audience and get their reaction, because that really was an ending, I think, for the era that must have shocked the heck out of audiences.
It shocked me when I watched it.
Well, yeah, me too. I'll tell you the story is because I had the little 8mm cut down of The Public Enemy I got as a birthday present when I was younger. So a little digest print. And in that little digest print, the movie ends with him coming out of after the shootout and falling into the rain-swept gutter. And that's how the movie ended there. So I thought, well, that's where the movie ends. So when I finally did see The Public Enemy, I thought, I thought the movie was supposed to end at this point. But instead you go into the hospital, the kidnapping, and we won't go into, you know.
Yeah.
Like you say, don't give the ending away. But I was, like you say, I was like stunned. I thought, whoa, I didn't expect this.
I was really, because it's also pre-code. And they got away with a lot of stuff in pre-code that they couldn't do just a couple of years later. And seeing that, I don't remember the first time I saw that, probably in my 20s. And it was just like, wowsville.
Yeah. I mean, again,
double
the audience at
wows.
The time must have gasped. They had a gasp, you know. In fact, without giving the ending away, James Cagney apparently wrote his mother prior to the release of the film, warning her against the ending so that she wouldn't be too, you know.
Yeah, a little horrified.
What,
yeah.
What happened? Yeah. Yeah, horrified, exactly.
Here
exactly.
I am, Ma. Yeah.
It's not me, Ma. It's the character, see?
Mm. Yeah. So we will go on to another wonderful classic mobster 30 flick, which is Scarface, starring Paul Muni and also co-starring Ann Dvorak and your guy, George Raft. And what a wonderful film. What a great job they all did.
Well, that's probably the most violent film of the era. You know, when you look at Little Caesar and outside of a few incidents in The Public Enemy, they're pretty mild in the graphic content, whereas Scarface went all out. Howard Hughes, the producer, said, you know, let's just make the best gangster film we can. And, of course, it went through a number of problems with the censors in that prior to release because it was very violent, very graphic. And yeah, it probably stands as the greatest of the early gangster films based on that.
Yeah, and you got to give Paul Muni major props for playing that because Paul Muni, you know, generally he was not thrilled about playing gangsters.
No, in fact, when he was offered the role, I believe Howard Hawks had come backstage where he was appearing in Counselor at Law. Mm-hmm. Don't forget, Muni had done some films prior to that. In fact, he was nominated for an Academy Award for his early work, which he didn't receive. And he became very disillusioned with Hollywood, went back to the stage, which was his first love, was appearing in Elmer Rice's Counselor at Law. And Howard Hawks came backstage to offer him the role of Scarface, of Tony Calante in Scarface. And Muni turned it down. He says, I'm just not that kind of man. He just couldn't see himself playing, even though he had done the movie The Valiant, where he plays a man on death row. To him, this was a part completely foreign to his personality and his nature. And he turned the role down. And actually, it was his wife who brokered the deal for him.
Wasn't she his manager? She was sort of like his manager?
Indirectly. I don't know if she was ever technically his agent, but she was his acting coach, definitely, where she would come on the set.
And his advisor as well.
Yeah.
On what to take and what not to take. Right.
Yeah. And if he was doing a scene in a film, he would not even look at the director sometimes. Hmm. He would look directly at her. And if she nodded yes, I mean, he was happy with the scene or she was happy with the scene. And if not, then he'd be shot. So she had a lot of control over his career, actually.
Huh, that's funny. That's very Marilyn Monroe with her acting teachers. I didn't know that. Paul Muni was a great actor. He did some wonderful work. But I thought he was really spectacular in this. And, of course, your guy, George Raft, who I adored in this film. Did George want to take this film?
Did he want to do this film?
Because he didn't really want to do a lot of the gangster flicks.
Well, later on in his career, but don't forget, when he came to Hollywood, he did a few little bits. I mean, if we do a show on George Raft, we can go through the whole biography thing again there. But at this point, he had done did some bit parts. I guess his major part prior to doing Scarface was he played Spencer Tracy's bodyguard, Jimmy Kirk, in the film Quick Millions.
Don't forget Night After Night with May.
Well, that came after, though. That was after Scarface.
And that was his first leading role.
That was his first starring role. Yeah, he had done some other parts between Scarface and Night After Night, but he wasn't a leading man at that point. Night After Night was his first starring film. Night After Night, pardon me.
He smashed it,
anyway,
though. I thought he was great.
Oh yeah, that's a fun film to watch. He plays a gangster in that one too.
With May, May was first her. It was her first scene. That's her first movie she did.
Well, that was thanks to George Raft, too, because initially Paramount was thinking about casting Texas Geenan in the role of Maudie. And Raft said, well, you know, Texas would be, she's a friend of mine, she'd be good, but I know a woman who'd be sensational. And on his recommendation, Mae West was given the part and became a huge star, even bigger than George was, I think as far as earnings go, I think she made more money than him.
She did. Business savvy. She did. She was incredible. When she got her contract, she said, who makes the most money at the studio?
That's right.
And it was the head of the studio, and she said,
Zucker, Adolf Zucker, yeah.
And she said, well, I want more than that. And I think she got like a dollar more than he did. And she brought the studio back. They were in.
Oh, yeah.
They were not doing well. They were losing tons of dough. And May's movies just made a ton of money. Oh, yeah. She was fabulous. Anyway, she was great. Back to Georgie. He was great.
Anyway, he had done some parts, some small parts. Again, the biggest one was in Quick Millions, playing Spencer Tracy's bodyguard. And apparently Howard Hawks had seen the movie and actually ran into George Rapp at the fights one night and asked him to come by the studio to talk to him about a part in this movie he was producing, Hawks. Mm-hmm. And so George did. And Hawks offered him the part of Gino Rinaldo in Scarface, you know, Paul Muni's right-hand man, based on Frankie Rio, who was Al Capone's right-hand man. And Ralph says, I would like to do the film, of course. You know, I could certainly use the work, but if this doesn't come off, I'm going to be working with Oney Madden's Boxing Carnival in Florida, where they're promoting Primo Canero, the heavyweight fighter. And Howard Hawks said to him, says, no, starting today, you're on salary. So George was excited, went across the street. Paul Muni's sitting in the restaurant where Raft went to get a bite to eat. Muni actually looks up from his table, sees George Raft, doesn't know him from a hole in the ground, and kind of signals for George to come over. Raft walks over to the table. Muni says, you know, you would be just great for this movie I'm doing, a gangster movie called Scarface. And Raft says, you mean the Howard Hawks movie? And Muni says, yeah. And then Raft says, well, that's really funny of you to say that, because I just saw Mr. Hawks and got the part. And Muni was delighted, stood up, shook his hand, said, wonderful. And that began their work together in Scarface.
They were great together in Scarface. And I loved his
terrific thing.
Who thought of the quarter bit?
Well, that's always been a point of conversation. Howard Hawks claims credit for it. George Raft claims credit for it, because apparently Raft knew a gangster in New York. And that was one of his habits, was he would flip a coin. And that's really hard to say. And then Raft also told the story that he was kind of unsure of himself as an actor doing these scenes. And mm-hmm. there were, a lot of periods there where he would just kind of be there. Muni would be having all the action. So for him, something to do, Raft, he claimed, he took out the coin and began flipping it, trying to mimic the actions of this gangster he knew in New York. And Howard Hawks at first was kind of upset with him and said, what are you doing that for, And, well, Raft said, just a little piece of business. And Hawks didn't really like the idea and didn't want him to do it until he watched The Rushes and thought, wow, that's a good little trick there. So he decided to keep it in there. That's one story. But, it's never really been, I think, said for certain what initiated that. Because later on, Hawks himself said, I did it to give George something to do with his scenes with Muni.
That's so funny.
Who knows?
Yeah, because you hear all these stories and from every movie, from everything, that there's always not just one, there's quite a few. So,
quite a few stories.
But whatever it was a good move. It was a very good part.
Well, it made him a star. I mean, when you think about it, there were two scenes in Scarface that made him a star. And one was the coin flipping, and the other was his death scene in Scarface when Paul Muni finds out he's been fooling around with his sister.
Yes, knowing his sister in a biblical way.
Exactly.
But
they were married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They were married, but see, Scarface didn't know that. He thought that, he was not, being honorable to his sister and being very protective of her. And that's another pre-code thing there, how protective of her was Tony Camonte. And don't forget that famous line in the movie, you don't act like a brother to me. Sometimes you act more like and then they cut the line there.
Right.
You know what she's going to say,
Yes.
So.
It was he had a natural, we would say, feelings for his sister. They weren't they went above and beyond what a brother would generally, take on
Poppy,
with a sister.
Poppy wasn't enough for him, obviously.
I love her. I'm going to do a
Karen
podcast,
Morley,
with a guy I like very much about they could have been contenders. They should have been contenders. And she's one of them, Karen Morley. And Poppy was great. She was natural. She was really good in that. And she was not enough for him. No.
And of course, there's also Osgood Perkins, who played Johnny Lovo, the boss, who, tries to betray Tony and ends up getting shot for his troubles. And he, of course, was the father of Anthony Perkins from Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
And Boris Karloff as well.
Oh, that's right. Boris was in that. Boris did a couple those gangster flicks.
He did a few gangster films early in his career. Definitely, yes. He was pretty good, too.
Yeah. I can't remember one that I saw that he was ahead of one and his son wanted to get away from it and then the daughter. I can't remember the name of it. Anyway.
That was called The Guilty Generation.
You Robert knew Young. It? Just from me saying yes, that.
Robert Young played his son.
Did you ever play Name Leo That Tune?
Leo Carrillo was in that picture.
Good for
too.
You. So who was the woman? He didn't want anything to do with his father. And then this woman, he didn't know that her father was a gangster. He went to like this soiree. I can't think of the woman.
I can't think of the woman myself. I remember Leo Carrillo, Boris Karloff, and Robert Young playing Boris Karloff's son. Is interesting story about that movie is that Karloff's part was supposed to be bigger, but at the same time he was hired for Frankenstein, so they had to cut his part down quite a bit. And if you watch the movie, you'll see he disappears for long stretches.
Yes, I remember that.
Because he was actually doing Frankenstein during that time.
The movie that made him a household name. Yes, forever and ever and ever.
The boogeyman.
The boogeyman. He wasn't the monster, though. It was Mr. Dr. Frankenstein who was a monster.
That's true. I mean, he was actually a pretty sympathetic soul, but, yeah.
He didn't want to come back to life. He didn't want to be, given bolts and stuff in his head.
Well, without getting off topic too much, the telling line comes in the second film, Bride of Frankenstein, where Karloff's monster says, "Love dead, hate living." And that pretty much sums up his whole existence.
Poor baby. Yeah, the way she reacted to him, not knowing that she wasn't exactly a rose petal herself. Yeah. It's like, I'm sorry, honey. Maybe you should check yourself out in the mirror before you start screaming at your potential mate here.
That's right. Correct.
Anyway, so Scarface was wonderful. And Muni just didn't want to get typecast in it. Another one he did, but it's not a gangster film. I was a fugitive from a chain gang. I never knew it was based on a real story. And the guy
Robert Burns, yeah.
Yeah, he was a fugitive at the time. He came to Burbank and was in hiding and went out and talked to Muni about it. And then he had to get away because said they're going to catch me, which is fascinating. And that's one of the saddest movies. Can't even talk about it. So, hence, we won't. And we'll go on.
One point's interesting. You say it's not a gangster film, but if you actually watch the film, it is probably the evolution of a gangster because he's a criminal by the end of the film. He's got to be a criminal.
It's so sad.
He probably does become, we're not talking about the real Robert Burns because everything worked out pretty good for him, but the character that Muni played, James Allen, he, I think, probably would have evolved into a gangster, a criminal.
I steal. How do you get along? I steal. Then the night lights go out. What a great movie. Okay, Stone, I think this was really, when was Dead End? What year was that
made?
Dead
End was, that was 1937.
Ah, so this was Bogey's really biggie first tough guy role in The Petrified Forest. That was 1935?
35, correct. But he did two other gangster films prior to that, or he played gangsters in two other films. He was in Three on a Match,
and he
was in Midnight, and he played a gangster in both of those. But that didn't instantly lead to him getting cast as Duke Mantee in The Petrified Forest, of course. That was thanks to Leslie Howard, who said, "No Bogart, no Howard."
Yes, they did it on Broadway together. Bogey was a big Broadway dude. And Leslie fought for him, and Bogart never forgot it. And his daughter, her name was after Leslie Howard. Her name was Leslie, which I think was a nice thing to do. And we know poor Leslie had a horribly young demise. And I love when you hear these stories about loyalty of these people who say, "I'm going to do this, but I want this person there, and I won't do it unless this person's there." So I thought that was really, really great of Leslie. What do you think about Bogey in it?
Oh, I love it. I think it's a great film. It's a great showcase for Bogart. Don't forget, Duke Mantee, pardon me, is based on John Dillinger. And Bogart, in researching the part, actually was watching a lot of newsreel footage on Dillinger and reading all of the information he could. And he does. I mean, he resembled John Dillinger.
Huh. Well, it was very good. Basically, the plot is that they're in Arizona, right?
That's right. Yep, the Petrified Forest.
And they go to that little Nowheresville cafe, and there's Betty Davis dreaming of, I think her mother was French or something, and dreaming of going, and then stumbles poor and hungry poet Leslie Howard. And then stumbles Duke Manatee, this horrible wanted man who's on the radio, and his mobsters. Which is interesting. I've got to mention this. This, I have never seen an African-American guy as a gangster in one of the early gangster films, not treated any differently than anybody else.
That is different, isn't it? You know, I've seen the film so many times, but I've never, I don't think because of, you know, the political climate is so much different today. I don't know how it would have been back in 35, but to look at that, I never even think about the fact that he's African-American. He's run the gang, you know. But back then, it does make you wonder if people kind of said, whoa, this is kind of different casting.
Well, I liked it because you notice it because you never see it in any of the gangster movies, the early gangster films. So I obviously noticed it. And I thought he was, you know, I was like, I can't believe they did it, but good for them, you know, to finally.
Good for them, absolutely.
Because otherwise, you know, they were like, yes, no.
Oh,
and
I know. They were
so offensive.
It's so sadly typecast. Oh, the Stephen Fetchit.
Really, I just hated it. So that's why I mention it. And obviously I noticed it because I've never seen it before in a gangster, in a classic film.
And he's given a character. He's not just, like you say, a feet to your stuff kind of guy.
No, he's one of the gang. You know? He is one of the gang.
Absolutely.
So they go there. And there's a snobby couple that's also in there. I think, didn't they hitchhike with Duke Manatee or something? I don't know what happened. Their car broke down.
Leslie Howard leaves with them. I'm trying to remember now. I know that they get waylaid by the Manatee gang, and the Manatee gang takes their car to the diner, to the cafe, and then they end up there, the rich couple and Leslie Howard.
And that big palooka guy who pumped gas, who wanted to.
Duke Foran, yes, he played, the guy who has the crush on Betty Davis.
And Betty,
and actually,
interestingly enough,
going back to the play, when Bogart was going to audition for that or be up for the part in that production, they wanted him to play the football player.
You're kidding.
That's the original choice.
Huh.
But the story that I heard, whether this is true or not, I don't know, but Leslie Howard, he had an interest in the play and in the film and everything. Which is why he could say, you know, no Bogart, no me, because, you know, he had an interest in that.
But
he
apparently had clout.
The story that I heard, he had clout, exactly.
Yeah.
Because he was a backer of the play or an investor. Anyway, pardon me. The story I heard was that he was actually watching the auditions, and when Bogart came on stage, Bogart lowered his voice, and, you know, Leslie Howard had a cultured, educated type sound to his voice there. And he says, you know what? He's the man for Duke Manatee because our voices are natural enemies. And I thought, wow, that makes sense.
It does make sense.
Talk.
And
totally.
Bogey was way too old to be that kind of football player. He did not look like a football player. He didn't speak like a football player. He was perfect.
No.
I cannot even imagine. I mean, he'd have to play like a lunkhead. And you really can't see him as like this big lunkhead guy ever.
Exactly. I mean, he wasn't a big man. Physically, Bogart was not a big man.
I think he was about 5'9".
Yeah, and he was thin. Mm-hmm. He was very thin. So, I mean, they could pat him up to play Duke Manatee, but they could never have patted him up to do the part that Dick Foran did.
Right.
That would work.
And Betty was there as sort of she had a big crush on Leslie. And it's an interesting film, the way it ends.
It's a good film.
And
yeah.
I really like the married couple and how she's like disgusted by her husband after she sees how wonderful and romantic Leslie Howard is and what he does. And we won't ruin it for you, but it's a really good film. Bogey's great.
I like that part you mentioned, Grace, because it's true. Because I mean, rich woman, materialistically, why she has everything, but she's not happy in her marriage with Paul Harvey. You can see that they're not a happy. You know, she's not happy anyway, and he just seems to be, you know, Paul Harvey, the character. So, or the actor, probably he was the actor, the character, the rich man he played. Like, obviously, there wasn't an affectionate relationship.
No, not at all. And she just thought, what a guy. Leslie was very good in this. You know, I never liked him, but I love him now. I just love Leslie Howard. He's done some really good films, and he was a very good actor. And yes. I love knowing behind the scenes, he was like this handsy. He would have, what someone said, he'd have his hand on my butt, and then he'd have his hand on someone, another woman. Now he'd be Me Too'd, you know, but at that time, Leslie.
Yeah.
Joan Blondell said he was the cutest, most charming. You couldn't get mad at him. He was just like an
imp. You know what?
Anyway, next thing, watch. Yes. These are all wonderful films. If you haven't seen them, check them out. The next one I think is wonderful, and it's such a great teaming. Each Dawn I Die, with George Raft and Jimmy Cagney.
Well, that's a wonderful film. That was the first film that George Raft made for Warner Brothers after leaving Paramount, where he had 22 suspensions at the studio, which I think was a record.
Wow.
Where the number of roles he turned down.
Were they all gangster roles? Was that why?
No. He turned down some pretty good ones. I mean, he turned down Beau Jest, that I think Ray Milland took his part, if I'm not mistaken.
Mm-hmm.
And some B films that he had done, but he did turn down a lot of films that Lloyd Nolan stepped into and actors of that type. So he finally left Paramount in 38 and signed with Warner Brothers to do Each Dawn I Die. For $5,000 a week, Jack Warner balked at paying that kind of money because he wanted to put Bogart actually in the Hood.
Wouldn't have worked the same.
No, it wouldn't have worked because he was much better suited to playing an enemy of Cagney, you know, a rival.
Yeah, they just didn't have this. These two were just like a bromance.
I love
them. They were great together. They were a great team. They seemed to respect each other. They played each other, played off each other well. Neither was trying to be, okay, look at me. They were both equals and both equally great.
And Jimmy Cagney was very complimentary. Like he often said that George Raft stole the movie from him, you know, because he played, I guess maybe in a sense, a more colorful role as the gangster. But Cagney, he explodes on the screen.
Yeah.
He's in that movie, you know, he does.
Because he gets framed by the mob. And of course, there's the district attorney's in on it, too. He works for a newspaper and he's trying to find out the scoop. So. They hit him over the head, then they pour alcohol over him, and he hits people. But it wasn't really him. It was them making it so he'd go to the slammer. And he breaks down there. And you see this guy going in, and it's true. Each dawn he dies. And his transformation from an idealistic reporter to what he became was amazing. And George Raft was his pal, and they were great.
It's an amazing performance from Cagney. In fact, he should have gotten a nomination because he goes from, like you say, an idealistic reporter, you know, a good man, to gradually becoming a hardened convict. You know, he is when he's turned down from the parole board and everything. It's just an amazing performance he gives. Like he always does. Cagney was just, you know, what can you say?
He also has this amazing crying scene when he gets turned down. And nobody, I mean, a gangster crying, it's unheard of. A man crying, even in classic films, I mean, it's unheard of. And here's this guy. He wasn't a gangster. He was just a regular guy trying to earn a living, thrown into this horrible circumstance, and they weren't going to let him go. And he cried. No. Nobody cried like Jimmy. He breaks your heart, man.
You know, you know what scene? You know what my favorite scene in that movie is?
What?
Is the scene where after he meets with his mother and Jane Bryan in the waiting room of the prison, and he's so emotional, and as he walks out, going back into the jute mill, you can see he's upset, he's got tears in his eyes, but as he walks that way back to the jute mill, all of a sudden you see the hard guy come back into him. Like he transforms from being emotionally upset by that meeting with his mother and his girlfriend to going back to being the tough guy. And that is one of the best scenes. It's done so perfectly, the way he transforms so subtly but so completely back into the prison guy.
And this movie, I highly recommend it. I am not a big gangster mama, gangster mall dame, but I do love a good gangster flick. And these, all that we've mentioned, are amazing. And if you haven't seen them, please do. This is so great. And George Raft, the ending I love, and we can't say it, you know.
No.
It was so adorable. And sad, but it was adorable. Anyway, it's a wonderful film, Each Dawn I Die. And I think we're getting to, which one? Was that the last one? We're going to talk about, I guess, why don't we talk about when Cagney got nominated for an Academy Award?
Well, that was the film he made prior to Each Dawn I Die. That was Angels with Dirty Faces.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the film he made after he returned to Warner Brothers after a contract dispute, and he signed with a small company called Grand National Pictures. He made a couple of movies there called Great Guy and Something to Sing About, a musical. And finally, Grand National, I think we're running short of cash, whatever. He had a good deal with them financially, but the movies were not up to Warner Brothers standards. So he came back to Warner's and did a picture with Pat O'Brien called Boy Meets Girl, a kind of a screwball comedy.
Mm-hmm.
And then he was in Angel with Dirty Faces, which is apparently Grand National Pictures owned the rights to the story, and they sold them back to Warner's, thank God, because I don't think Grand National could have produced the movie the way Warner's did. And here's Cagney. I mean, I would say my favorite James Cagney gangster role. I think most people agree with me that I've talked to on various film sites about Cagney. He plays Rocky Sullivan, based so much on people he knew, Cagney knew in his youth, you know, characteristics and little things like that. He just, again, such a creative guy for an actor, for someone.
Dead End Kids were in that too, right?
The Dead End Kids, that was their second, well, mm-hmm. not their second film, but their first, I believe their first for Warner's. Don't forget, they made their debut in Dead End
right.
with Bogart. And then they they signed a contract with Warner's and did Angels and some other films. But yeah, it was Cagney's big comeback to Warner's and garnered him his first Academy Award nomination, which he lost to Spencer Tracy for Boys Town. And I have my feelings as to why that happened.
Why did that happen? Tell us, Stone.
Because I don't think the Academy was comfortable giving the award over an actor playing a priest to a guy playing a gangster.
How silly, right? Well, didn't all guys play she didn't win for Bells of St. Mary, did she, Ingrid Bergman? When she played the nun?
I don't think she did. No,
that's what I thought she did. And didn't Bing Crosby win for
Going My Way?
Going My Way. So I think you're right. If you play a padre or a sister, you're going to get an Academy Award most likely.
Well, especially if you're competing against a guy playing a gangster. But let's be honest. When you, I mean, I love Tracy. Wonderful actor. And he was very good in Boys Town. But come on, Cagney was dynamic.
He was incredibly dynamic. And if you guys, the end scene, oh my goodness.
Oh yeah.
Holy Toledo. And Pat O'Brien, and he and Cagney were really, really great friends. And he played a priest in this. And Ann Sheridan was in it as well. And it was just a really great film. And it's a shame because, you know, I don't like Boys Town at all. I have to be honest with you. And I think he was robbed. But there was a lot of people robbed.
Well, everybody thought Cagney was a shoo-in for the Oscar because he won the New York Critics Film Award. And that generally was an, a barometer as to, you know, who's going to win the best actor. And Cagney, if he was, I think he was the favorite. But again, I think it was just, they were timid there. Do we award a guy for playing a gangster, or do we give it to a guy playing a priest? I mean, that's my feeling anyway.
Yeah.
And because I mean, yeah, Boys Town. Okay, I don't. I wouldn't bring that movie to a desert island with me. You know what I'm saying? But it's good, and Tracy's as good as can be. But my God, I mean, Cagney is. I mean, he's all over the place. He's, and if you see the ending alone, is Academy Award.
Oh, I love it. It's just like nothing you expect, and it just if. The first time I saw it, I was blown away. I just thought it was amazing, amazing, amazing.
You know, when I first saw that movie, it was like back in 1972 up here in Canada, CBC television, their late shows used to have a thing on Monday nights called Vintage Cagney. And they played a lot of Cagney movies between September to Christmas. And I saw Angels for the first time during that time. And my mom and I were actually watching the late movie. We watched Angels. And after that movie ended, we just sat there in silence for the longest time. We were both so stunned by that ending, you know.
I was by myself watching that ending, and I was just like, wow. So, I mean, I think we did. You really have to watch these movies, you racketeers, you. Little Caesar, Scarface, Public Enemy, Petrified Forest, Each Dawn I Die, and our last film we discussed, Stoney?
Angels.
Angels with Dirty Faces.
Angels, yes.
And I want to thank you, Stone, once again. And he's going to come on. Well, he wrote a wonderful biography on George Raft. And it's called The Man That Would Be Bogart. And we'll talk about why he named it that book. But you will enjoy it a lot. I read it and I, you know, couldn't care less about George Raft beforehand. After I read the book, I was like, I love him. So, I did.
Well, that's a compliment. Well, thank you.
Yes, but it did. I really liked him. I usually don't read, you know, I kind of skim through childhoods a lot. You know, I just kind of get the basic gist of where they come from, but I didn't. He was fascinating, came from Hell's Kitchen and just a lot of great stuff. But this was fabulous again, Stone. Thank you so much. And you guys will hear more of Stone on True Stories of Tinseltown on Racketeer Radio. And I hope you enjoyed it. I had a really good time. Thank you so much, Stone. And thanks.
Thank you, Grace. Always a pleasure.
And thanks, peeps, for listening. And till next time. Bye, everybody.